For 5 years, no one touched me. Not one person. Not my wife, not my child, not my friends. No one touched me. They saw me. They spoke to me. I sensed love in their voices, and I saw concern in their eyes, but I didn't feel their touch. There was no touch. Not once. No one touched me. What is common to you, I coveted. Handshakes, warm embraces, a tap on the shoulder, a kiss. Such moments were taken from me. No one touched me. No one bumped into me. What I would have given to be bumped into, for myself to be caught in a crowd, for my shoulder to brush up against another's. But for 5 years, that has not happened. And how could it? I was not allowed on the streets. I was not even permitted in my own synagogue. Rabbis kept their distance from me, not even welcome in my own house. I was untouchable. I was a leper, and no one touched me until today. 1 year during the harvest, my grip on the scythe seemed so weak, and the tips of my fingers began to get numb. First it was one finger, then it was another finger. Within a short time, I could scarcely feel anything on the tool. By the end of the season, I felt nothing at all. The hand grasping the tool might as well belong to someone else. The feeling was gone. And I said nothing to my wife, but I knew that she suspected something. How could she not? I held my arm at my side like a wounded bird. And one afternoon, I plunged my hands into a basin of water, intending to wash my face, and the water reddened. My finger was bleeding, and it was bleeding freely. I didn't even know that I was wounded. How did I cut myself? Was it on a knife? Did my hand slide across the sharp metal? It must have. But I didn't feel anything. It's on your clothes too, my wife said softly. She was behind me. And before looking at her, I looked down at the crimson spots on my robe. And for the longest time, I stood over the basin, staring at my hand, knowing that somehow my life was going to be changed forever. It was going to be forever altered. She asked if she should go to the priest with me, and I told her no, that I would go alone. And I turned and looked into her moist eyes, and standing next to her was our 3-year-old daughter. And so I squatted down, and I gazed into her eyes, and I stroked her cheek, saying nothing. What could I have said? I stood there and looked at my wife. She touched my shoulder, and with my good hand, I touched hers. And it would be our final touch. 5 years have passed, and no one has touched me since. Until today. The priest didn't touch me. He looked at my hand, not yet wrapped in a rag. He looked at my face, now shadowed in sorrow. And I've never faulted him for what he said. He was only doing what he was instructed to do. He covered his mouth and extended his hand, palm forward. You are unclean, he told me. With one pronouncement, I lost my family. I lost my farm. I lost my friends. And I lost my future. And so my wife met me at the city gates with a sack of clothing, some bread, and some coins. She didn't speak, and by now some friends have gathered. They didn't speak. And what I saw in their eyes was a precursor to what I have seen every day since in everyone else's eyes. Fearful pity. And as I stepped out, they stepped back. Their horror for my disease was greater than their concern for my heart. So they, and everyone else since, I have seen since this time, have stepped back. How I repulsed those who saw me. 5 years of leprosy had left my hands gnarled. The tips of my fingers were missing, as were portions of my ears and my nose. At the sight of me, fathers grabbed their children. Mothers covered their faces. Children pointed and stared. The rags on my body could not hide the sores, nor could the wrap on my face hide the rage in my eyes. I didn't even try to hide it anymore. How many nights did I shake my crippled fist at the silent sky? What did I do to deserve this? But never a reply. And some think that I have sinned. Some think that my parents have sinned. I don't know. All I know is that I grew so tired of it all. Sleeping in the colony, smelling the stench. I grew so tired of the bell that I had to wear around my neck to warn people that I was coming, to warn them of my presence, as if they even needed it. One glance and the announcements began. Unclean. 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 Several weeks ago, I dared walk the road to my village, and I had no intent of entering. Heaven knows, I only wanted to look again upon my fields, gaze upon my home, and just maybe see my wife. I didn't see her, but I did see some children playing. I hid behind a tree and watched them scamper and run around. Their faces were so joyful. Their laughter was so contagious that for a moment, just for that moment, I was no longer a leper. I was a farmer again. I was a father. I was a man. Infused with their happiness, I stepped out from behind the tree. I straightened my back and I breathed so deeply. And they saw me. Before I could retreat, they saw me. They screamed, they ran, they scattered all over. But one lingered, though, behind all of the others. One paused and looked in my direction. Now, I don't know. I can't say for sure. But I think that was my daughter. And I don't know. Again, I can't say for sure. But I think that she was looking for her father. That is what made me take the step I took today. Of course it was reckless. Of course it was risky. But what did I have to lose? He calls himself God's son. Either he would hear my complaint and kill me, or he would accept my demands and heal me. Those were my thoughts. So I came to him. As a defiant man, not moved by faith, but by desperate anger. God had allowed this calamity on my body, and he would either fix it or he wouldn't. But then I saw him. And when I saw him, I was changed. Now you must remember, I'm a father, I'm a farmer, I'm a simple person. I'm not a poet. So I can't find the words to best describe what I saw. All I can say is that the Judean mornings are sometimes so fresh, and the sunrises so glorious, that to look upon them is to forget the hurt of times past and to forget the heat of the day before. And when I looked at Jesus' face, I saw a Judean morning. Now, before Jesus spoke, I knew that he cared, that somehow he hated this disease more than me, or he hated it at least just as much as I did. My rage became trust, and my anger became hope. From behind a rock, I watched as Jesus descended down a hill. A large group of people were following him, and so I waited until he was only paces from me, and then I stepped out. "Master," I called to him. Jesus stopped and looked in my direction, as did dozens of other people. A flood of fear swept across the crowd. Arms flew in front of their faces. Children ducked behind their parents. "Unclean," someone shouted in the distance. Again, I don't blame them. I was a hurtled mass of death, but I scarcely heard them. To be honest, I scarcely saw them. Their panic I'd seen 1,000 times, but Jesus' compassion I've never seen. Everyone stepped back from me, except Jesus. He stepped toward me. He stepped toward me. 5 years ago, my wife had stepped towards me. She was the last person to do so. Now Jesus did. And I did not move. I just spoke, "Lord, you can heal me if you will." Had Jesus healed me with a word, I would have been thrilled. Had he cured me with a prayer, I would have been satisfied. I would have rejoiced. But Jesus wasn't satisfied with just speaking to me. He drew near to me. Jesus came toward me. 5 years ago, my wife touched my shoulder. No one had touched me since. Until today. "I will." Jesus' words were as tender as his touch. "Be healed." An energy flooded my body like water through a droughted field. In an instant, in a moment, I felt warmth where there had been numbness. I felt strength where there had been weakness. My back straightened, my head lifted up. Where I had been eye level with his belt, I now stood eye level with Jesus' face, his smiling face. He cupped his hands to my cheek and drew me so near I could feel the warmth in his breath. And I can see the wetness in his eyes. "Don't tell anyone about this, but go and show yourself to the priest and offer the gift Moses commanded for the people who are made well. This will show the people what I have done." And so that's where I'm going. I will show myself to my priest and I will embrace him. I will show myself to my wife and I will embrace her. I will pick up my daughter and I will embrace her. And I will never forget the one who dared to touch me. Jesus could have healed me with a word, but he wanted to do more than heal me. He wanted to honor me. Jesus wanted to validate me. Imagine that. Unworthy of the touch of man, yet worthy of the touch of God. Now, that was a dramatized version of Max Lucado, coming from his mind, one of my favorite authors, and that's one of his dramatized versions of the verses that we're going to go through. And the reason that I wanted to do the sermon on this verse this morning is that, sadly, whenever I make my opinions more important than the difficult people that God made, I end up turning the wine back into water. I end up making a mess of things. And so this morning, we're going through all of this, but it's short, I promise. So this is where Jesus heals the man with leprosy. And it says, "When Jesus came down from the mountainside, a large crowd followed him. A man with leprosy came and knelt before him and said, 'Lord, if you are willing, you can heal me. You can make me clean.'" And in Luke 5, It gives us a little bit more information. It says, while Jesus was in one of the towns, a man came along who was covered with leprosy. When he saw Jesus, he fell with his face to the ground and begged him, Lord, if you are willing, you can make me clean. Now, what is a leper doing in the city? He was forbidden to be around non-leprous people. He was banned from cities. And that's why Luke, in some translations, says, behold. What he is saying is, he is saying, look, you need to look at these verses. They are very important. He is saying, check this out. This should never be happening. A leper never went into a city. So why is he here? Why is he coming to Jesus? Because he's absolutely desperate. He is determined to do anything he has to do in order to get to Jesus, even including breaking Jewish rules about leprosy. And not only that, but in Matthew, we see that a large crowd was following Jesus. In the ancient world, leprosy is a terrible, destructive disease, and it still is in some parts of the world. The ancient leper had no hope of improvement, so this leper came to Jesus with a great sense of need and desperation. Theologian Barclay says this about leprosy. Leprosy might begin with the loss of all sensation in some parts of the body. The nerve trunks are affected. The muscles waste away. The tendons contract until the hands are like claws. There follows ulceration of the hands and feet. Then comes the progressive loss of fingers and toes until in the end a whole hand or a whole foot may drop off. The duration of that kind of leprosy is anywhere from 20 to 30 years. It is the kind of terrible progressive death in which a man dies by inches. And so lepers lived in a community with other lepers until they either got better or they died. This was the only way the people knew how to contain this contagious disease. In the Bible, the word leprosy is mentioned about 40 times. The main reason why leprosy is talked about so much in the Bible is that it is a graphic illustration of sin's destructive power. In ancient Israel, leprosy was a powerful object lesson, and it still should be today, of the debilitating influence of sin in someone's life. God had given the Israelites very specific instructions on how to deal with leprosy and other skin diseases. Anyone suspected of having the disease had to go to a priest for examination, and if found to be infected, the leprous person who has the disease shall wear torn clothes and let their hair of their head hang loose, and he shall cover his upper lip and cry out, unclean, unclean. He shall remain unclean as long as he has the disease. He is unclean. He shall live alone. His dwelling shall be outside the camp. That is in Leviticus 13. The leper then was considered utterly unclean physically and spiritually. For all those reasons, the condition of leprosy is this model of sin and how we can view sin in our lives. According to Jewish law and customs, one had to keep about 6 feet or 2 meters from a leper. If the wind was blowing toward a person from a leper, they had to keep 150 feet away. Judge that on a windy day, I guess, right? The only thing more defiling than contact with a leper was contact with a dead body. Now take this next part with a grain of salt, but David Guzik says this. In Jesus' time, rabbis sometimes boasted about how badly they treated lepers. One bragged that he refused to buy even an egg on a street where he saw a leper. Another boasted that he threw rocks at lepers upon seeing them. Incurable by man, many believed God inflicted this curse of leprosy upon people for the sins they committed, or just maybe their parents, which is terrifying. Nevertheless, the leprosy-covered man came to Jesus by himself in desperate, through many discouragements. He knew how terrible this problem was. He knew that other people had given up on him as having a hopeless condition. He had no one who would take or could take him to Jesus. He had no previous example of Jesus healing a leper to give him any sense of hope about that. He had no promise that Jesus would heal him. He had no invitation from Jesus or the disciples. He must have felt so ashamed and alone in that crowd. The leper had no doubt whatsoever about the ability of Jesus to heal. His only question was if Jesus was willing to heal. And so in the next set of verses, Jesus reached out his hand and touched the man. "I am willing," Jesus said. "Be clean." Immediately he was cleansed of his leprosy. This was a bold and compassionate touch from Jesus. The idea is that the leper most likely kept his distance from Jesus. But Jesus put out his hand and touched him. It was against the ceremonial law to touch a leper, which made the touch all the more meaningful to the afflicted man and the crowd. Of course, as soon as Jesus touched him, though, he was no longer a leper. Even the word here for touch doesn't give it justice. It wasn't like a tag on the shoulder. The word here is literally he clung to him. He joined himself to him, so he got very close to this man. And what it says next is eternally awesome when you look at it in the Greek, because Jesus literally says, "I will cleanse." Just because you don't see a way doesn't mean that God doesn't have a way. And that's something to remember. Then Jesus said to him, "See that you don't tell anyone, but go and show yourself to the priest and offer the gift Moses commanded as a testimony to them." Now, I want to make something clear. I hope none of you in this room think this, but just so we don't take on the thoughts of the Pharisees, don't think this man had leprosy because he or his parents sinned. He is a sinner, just like you and I are, who happened to have leprosy. And maybe you have heard the key to this lesson that we need to learn is that sin defiles us in the sight of God. But through Jesus, we can be healed of the plague of sin that separates us from God. And yes, that is true. God can rescue us from sin and will rescue us from sin if we ask him. But what I want to focus on this morning is I want to focus on the gracious, loving touch that Jesus gives this man. God specializes in giving people a fresh start. In the book, Proof, a book on God's outrageous, irresistible grace, Timothy Paul Jones tells this story. "I never dreamed that taking a child to Disney World could be so difficult, or that such a trip could teach me so much about God's outrageous grace. Our middle daughter had been previously adopted by another family. I, Timothy, am sure this couple had the best of intentions, but they never quite integrated the adopted child into their family of biological children. After a couple of rough years, they dissolved the adoption, and we ended up welcoming an 8-year-old girl into our home. For one reason or another, whenever our daughter's previous family vacationed at Disney World, they took their biological children with them, but they left their adopted daughter with a family friend. Usually, at least in the child's mind, this happened because she did something wrong that precluded her presence on the trip. And so, by the time we adopted our daughter, she had seen so many pictures of the place she wanted to be, which is Disney World. And she had heard about the rides and the characters and the parades, but when it comes to passing through the gates of the Magic Kingdom, she had always been the one left on the outside. Once I found out about this history, I made plans to take her to Disney World the next time a speaking engagement took our family to the southern eastern United States. I thought I had mastered the Disney World drill. I knew from previous experiences that the prospect of seeing cast members in freakishly oversized mouse and duck costumes somehow turns children into squirming bundles of emotional instability. What I didn't expect was that the prospect of visiting this dream world would produce a stem of poor behavior in our newest daughter. In the month leading up to our trip to the Magic Kingdom, she stole food when a simple request would have gained her a snack. She lied when it would have been just easier to tell the truth. She whispered insults that were carefully crafted to hurt her older sister as deeply as possible. And as the days on the calendar moved closer to the trip, her mutinies multiplied. A couple of days before our family headed to Florida, I pulled our daughter into my lap to talk to her through her latest escapade. "I know what you're going to do," she stated flatly. "You're not going to take me to Disney World, are you?" The thought hadn't actually crossed my mind, but her downward spiral suddenly started to make some sense. She knew she couldn't earn her way into the Magic Kingdom. She had tried and failed that test several times before. So she was living in a way that placed her as far as possible from the most magical place on Earth. In retrospect, I'm embarrassed to admit that in that moment, I was tempted to turn her fear to my own advantage. The easiest response would have been, "If you don't start behaving better, you're right, we won't take you." But by God's grace, I didn't. Instead, I asked her, "Is this trip something we're doing as a family?" She nodded, brown eyes wide and tear-rimmed. "Are you a part of this family?" She nodded again. "Then you're going with us. Sure, there may be some consequences to help you remember what's right and what's wrong. But you're a part of our family, and we're not leaving you behind." I'd like to say that her behaviors grew better after that moment. They didn't. Her choices pretty much spiraled out of control at every hotel and rest stop all along the way. She's still with us, headed to Disney World on that day that we promised. And it was a typical Disney day, overpriced tickets, overpriced meals, and lots of lines mingled with just enough manufactured magic to consider maybe going again someday. In our hotel room that evening, a very different child emerged. She was exhausted, a little weepy at times, but her month-long facet of rebellion had faded. When bedtime rolled around, I prayed with her, held her, and asked her, "So how was your first day at Disney World?" She closed her eyes and snuggled down into her stuffed unicorn. After a few moments, she opened her eyes ever so slightly. "Daddy," she said, "I finally got to go to Disney World. But it wasn't because I was good. It's because I'm yours. It wasn't because I was good. It's because I'm yours." That's the message of outrageous grace. Outrageous grace isn't a favor you can achieve by being good. It's the gift you receive by being God's. Outrageous grace is God's goodness that comes looking for you even when you don't want to be pursued. It's a farmer paying a fool's day's wages to a crew of deadbeat day laborers with only 1 hour punched on their time cards. It's a man marrying an abandoned woman, then refusing to forsake his covenant with her when she turns out to be a prostitute. It's the insanity of a shepherd who puts 99 sheep at risk to rescue the single lamb that's too stupid to stay with the flock. It's the love of a father who hands over his finest rings and robes to a young man, a young son, who has squandered his inheritance on drunken days, drunken nights, with his fair-weathered friends. It's one-way love that calls you into the kingdom, not because you've been good, but because God has chosen you and made you his own. And now he is running after you to the ends of the earth to keep you as his child, and nothing in heaven or earth can ever stop him. But here's what's amazing about God's outrageous grace. This isn't merely what God the Father would do. It is what he did do. God could have chosen to save anyone, everyone, or no one from Adam's fallen race. But God did what he did was choose a multitude of someones. Those someones were you. God in Jesus has declared over you, "I could have chosen anyone in the whole world as my own child, and I chose you." No matter what you say, no matter what you do, neither my love nor my choice will ever change. That's grace. That's truly amazing. Mother Teresa said it like this: "Let us touch the dying, the poor, the lonely, and the unwanted according to the graces we have received, and let us not be ashamed or slow to do the humble work. Bob Goff says it like this. He, meaning Jesus, said we would identify ourselves simply by how we loved people. It's tempting to think there is more to it, but there's not. Love isn't something we fall into. Love is someone we become. Words and actions which do not give the light of Jesus only increase the darkness. The youth kids will be accustomed to me saying this, but I'm going to tell you it for the first time. Don't be afraid to call a sinner, but don't be afraid to go to their house for dinner. We must remember that. Let us not be satisfied with just giving money. Money is not enough. Money can be got, but they need your hearts to love them. So spread your love everywhere you go. Again, beautiful words by Mother Teresa. What I've come to realize is that I've spent a lot of time avoiding the people that I don't understand. Avoiding the ones that are different than me. Maybe you're in the same boat. Sure, I was polite to them. Sure, I gave them some concern. Sure, I love them because Jesus tells me to. But have you ever thought of it like this? We love those who are easy to love, and we tend to avoid those who are hard to love. The hard truth about that is that means we have spent our life avoiding the very people Jesus spent his life engaging. When we choose to love the people that are easy to love, anyone can do that. When we avoid the people that are hard to love, we're avoiding the people that spent his whole life loving and still is loving those people. Again, with Bob Goff, I think his words are brilliant. I think he's a very whimsical man. I think he says the gospel pretty well, but he says, love is never stationary. But the kind of love that God created and showed is a costly one because it involves sacrifice and presence. It's a love that operates more like a sign language rather than being spoken outright. That's what love does. It pursues blindly, unflinchingly, and without end. When you go after something you love, you'll do anything it takes to get it, even if it costs everything. Simply put, love does. We need to love everybody, always. No one expects us to love them flawlessly, but we can love them fearlessly, furiously, and unreasonably. Jesus never said doing these things would be easy. Jesus just said that they would work. Let's pray. Father God, I thank you for the time that we can come here today, God. And hopefully we can do some hard things in our life. We can love the hard people in our lives. God, I pray that you will give us the strength when we fail on that. God, I pray that you will let us leave this place changed, God. Better equipped for the gospel, God. Better equipped for you to love the people in our life, in our communities, those hard people to love, God. God, give us the strength to do so. God, thank you for Jesus. Thank you so much for Jesus, God. Thank you for what Jesus did for us on the cross. And it's in his name that we pray. Amen.
Y'all stand with us.